Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Saturday marked the start of National Bike Month. There are lots of events scheduled for Central Ohio. We've invited three guests to the show today to discuss safety, the bicycling culture, how it relates to sustainability, and safe biking practices. Joining me in the studio is Tricia Kovacs. She's been teaching a cycling course to adults and children since 2007. She is a commuter bicyclist and is currently working for the Gahanna Parks and Recreation Department on their Safe Routes to School and Bikeways programs. She works with state lawmakers on laws related to cyclists and with the Ohio Department of Public Safety on teaching motorists to share the road with cyclists. And Tricia, you bicycle everywhere, right?
As much as possible, yes.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Also, Meredith Joy, she's one of the founders of Consider Biking and also founder of Yay Bikes, sponsor of May Bike Month events throughout Central Ohio. And you're also, I understand, a newly sprouted instructor.
Yes, thank you. Yes.
Thanks for being on the show, Meredith.
Great.
And from somewhere around Cincinnati, I think, right, Steve Magus? He's an Ohio trial lawyer who specializes in bike law. He's called the Bike Lawyer. He has handled more than 200 bike-related cases, from $50 traffic tickets to $1 million death cases. And he's scheduled to speak in Columbus on May 18th at the Main Library on Grant Avenue. Go to WOSU.org/allsides for a link to that. More information about that and all the events that are scheduled to mark National Bike Month in Central Ohio. Steve, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Ann. I'm happy to be here.
Meredith, you only cycle as a commuter experience.
Right.
You don't necessarily spike for recreation, bicycle for recreation. How much does the culture of recreational bicycling, which has grown so much, and not to be confused with commuters, how has it helped or hurted the commuter culture?
Well, interestingly, I think there's far less overlap than one might expect. I do have friends who, for example, started with Pelotonia and then have become commuter cyclists. But people tend to think, oh, well, you can shift somebody to, like, they're low-hanging fruit. They already bike. They might as well just then start biking to work, for example. And in fact, it's very different. And I think that what I tend to focus on in my work is the individual experience of cycling. So, you know, mobility has different meanings for people. Mm-hmm. There's obviously different circumstances that lead to different types of power dynamics when you're talking about modes of transportation and access issues. And then there's identity issues also that go along with different types of cycling or different types of modes of transportation.
What do you mean by identity issues?
Well, you know, I identify as a cyclist because that's the way that I get around. That's my world. That's what I'm about, what I think is important, my value system. But somebody else might say that I just want to get away from everything when I bike. I'm not a cyclist. Or, you know, there's a million different ways in which that experience can manifest for somebody. And in fact, some people don't want to consider themselves a cyclist because that's sort of in their mind an outlaw, sort of renegade type anarchist, and it's a dangerous sort of identity to adopt for some people. So there's lots of different ways that can play out, and we can't assume that one type of cyclist would necessarily be another type of cyclist because it requires sometimes a big shift.
Well, I think, Ann, also the identity of cyclists between the racers and the commuters and the trail people, and now the sort of fixed gear group. I mean, there's definitely a wide diversity of identities within the cycling community itself. So it definitely plays out.
Do most, Meredith, you were saying that if you're a recreational cyclist, that does not necessarily translate into being a commuter.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole different mentality. What does trigger somebody to begin commuting by bike, usually?
Well, I would say there are some very obvious answers. One would be, you know, the economics of driving would, you know, when there's gas prices that are really high, people start to think of other options that they might not have considered. I would say that there's a community effect. So if somebody around you is a cyclist, then there's much more chance that you would feel comfortable doing it, particularly in your workplace, which is why we do the Bike to Work Challenge. And then, you know, there's, I think, a value system that tends to make people think of cycling as an option around sustainability issues and health and that sort of thing. So lots of different reasons. I tend to emphasize the personal connections. I think you can talk about, and people have talked about for a long time, the impact of infrastructure improvements on people's likelihood to bike. And that's important, obviously. But really, there's a human connection that allows people to feel like that it's okay to be sweaty, for example, or to, you know, make mistakes when they're out there on the road and not feel like a fool because they can laugh about it with somebody afterwards.
If they're not dead.
Well, but I've done stupid things too, and then like for blocks afterwards, I'm crying because I had an interaction, and it's just like,
oh yeah.
I mean, and it wasn't, you know, a
when
deadly
you say
interaction.
Interaction, but... you mean a negative one with a motorist?
Yeah, I mean, it can just throw you off and make you feel like a fool if you do something silly too. So I think that there's a lot of room for the community to really come together around people to help them make choices, because there's a lot of different people who might, I mean, you know, you think about who would be a cyclist, and you know, you might have an idea of somebody who would be a cyclist, and they're probably white and they might be middle class or upper class, and they're probably fit, physically fit and attractive maybe or whatever, but there's a whole world of people out there who you wouldn't automatically think of as a cyclist or somebody who would be a cyclist. And those are the people that we want ultimately to try cycling, because it's great fun and it's a great lifestyle to have. And so you have to start thinking about reaching out to those people and making it a safe space for them within the cycling community, so that they don't feel like, you know, oh, I'm carrying some extra weight and people are going to laugh at me and I'm going to feel ashamed of myself when I'm on the street.
Steve, when did your business sort of in bicycling law kind of kick into, no pun intended, high gear?
Well, it was way back. There was an ad in the Cincinnati Cycle Club newsletter that said, "Help, we need a lawyer." And they had let their nonprofit charter lapse, and they didn't know what to do. And I didn't know what to do because I didn't do that kind of law, but I was in the club and started to help out. And I had to actually get a signature from a motorcycle person who was in a smoky bar, a motorcycle bar in Cincinnati, because they had started the Cincinnati Motorcycle Club. That name was too close to the Cincinnati Cycle Club, so we had to get their agreement so we could renew our charter. And after getting that process, I started writing articles back in the mid-'80s. Those got picked up by Bike Ohio, then Bike Midwest, then Bike USA. And once I started doing that, I started representing cyclists, and I've probably done over 250 bike cases now. So,
right. Are bicyclists misunderstood?
Bicyclists on the roadway, I think, are misunderstood, because people in cars tend to think, A, what are they doing here? B, why aren't they riding on these nice bike paths that we're building for them? So there is a lack of education in the motoring world about the rights of bicycle riders to ride on the roads.
A lot
so
of
whether
people...
that's misunderstood or just not mm-hmm. not understood, I mean, you know, it's a difference.
There's no Ken whatsoever yet.
Yeah. Oh, I just wanted to say we often encounter motorists saying, why aren't you on the sidewalk? And we have to tell them it's illegal to ride on the sidewalk in Columbus and a lot of other cities too.
Right.
Tricia, how do you teach bicycling? Tell us what exactly it is you do teach. There's a couple different ways to look at bicycling. There's a safe way to bicycle, you know, pedal your bike. There's the physical manifestation of safe, and then there's the rules and regulations part of it.
Yeah, I guess when we teach, we go through all the basics about, you know, choosing the right bike for what you need, what you need to carry, if you need to fix a flat tire, clothing to wear, nutrition. But the basic thing, the important thing we teach is driving your bicycle in traffic, following all the traffic laws, because they all apply to bicycles, most of them, unless it says motor vehicles in the law, and then the specific laws for cyclists. But I didn't know this. I mean, I've been riding since I was like 12 years old. I always say 12 years old because that's when I did my first 100-mile bike ride. But I just knew I was supposed to ride on the right, but I didn't know like where on the right, you know, what position in the lane to be, where I should be when I'm taking left turn, what to look out for, where the most car bike accidents happen and how to avoid them. How to be assertive, what my rights are. Just there's all this stuff that we try to teach in the classes that people might not necessarily know.
Well, Steve, you know, you can teach a bicyclist all the rules in the book, and they can obey them as well. But if the motorists don't know the rules...
Well, it's true. The motorists, what we see is accidents being caused not because motorists don't know the rules so much. They get mad at cyclists, and they yell at them, and they try to run us off the road sometimes, and those are criminal offenses. But when crashes happen, it's generally the biggest complaint that the motorist has is, I just didn't see them. And to me, that I always say that's not an excuse. That's an admission of liability because they're just still getting used to us riding on the roads. The two biggest ways that accidents happen with motorists are called the right hook and the left cross. And mm-hmm. the right hook is where someone passes the cyclist and then makes a right turn and ends up hitting them. And the left hook is when somebody's coming towards you and makes a left turn in front of you and says, gee, I didn't see you. So it's not a lack of understanding of the law. It's just a unawareness that we're out there.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, I want to talk more about that right hook and what do you call it, the left cross and the right hook. If you have a question or comment for our guest today, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. It is national, National Bicycle Month, the month of May. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On Talk of the Nation, we like to be clear about what we're talking about, whether it's movies.
A B-movie was a movie that was made specifically to be on the bottom half of a double feature.
Or the auto industry.
One mid-level executive at a top automaker told me, well, 30 years ago, we were a car company that would occasionally lend money to our customers, and now we're a bank that makes cars.
Talk of the Nation. Clear, straight, open. From NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation begins this afternoon at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 66 degrees in downtown Columbus, some sunshine today, and a high of 78, a few clouds tonight, bringing a chance of rain, maybe a thunderstorm after midnight, a low of 53. There is some sunshine for Tuesday, a chance of a morning shower and a high of 75, and more sunshine on Wednesday.
Support for WOSU comes from Marburn Academy, inviting the community to a parent seminar on solving math learning problems May 4th at 7 p.m. More information at marburnacademy.org.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests are Tricia Kovacs. She's Ohio Bicycle Federation board member and Columbus League of Cycling instructor. Also Meredith Joy, founder of Yay Bikes, and also a brand new cycling instructor. And Steve Magus, he's Ohio's bike lawyer. He's calling us from Southwest Ohio, and where he practices majority of his practices. And also Steve's going to be in town in a few weeks. Go to WOSU.org/allsides for a link to all the events for National Bike Month in Central Ohio, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question, comment about, I guess, anything to do with cycling. Really, when you say National Bike Month, it doesn't say National Bike Safety Month. It says National Bike Month. But, Steve, I wanted to talk about that left cross and the right hook?
The right hook. That's right.
The right hook affects me often as a cyclist and as a motorist. because one, you know, everybody on both sides of the coin are maybe guilty of not following the rules or understanding them thoroughly. For instance, cyclists who are back in traffic, you don't see them because you're not watching 10 cars back. But as you come to a stop at the intersection, while you're stopped checking and looking around you, the bicyclist is coming up and quietly coming up beside you. And often, not supposed to be, but often they are. And that happens. And that's in a good situation. Sometimes they're on the sidewalk and doing that. And then you even have a less of a vantage point for spotting them. Steve, what are the rules when it comes to where the bike should be in the flow of traffic?
Well, the rules are, the basic rule is same roads, same rules. So if you are riding a bike on the road, you ought to be acting like a vehicle operator. You ought to be making predictable moves. You ought to be signaling turns. You ought to be taking a space in the lane. One of the key rules is you're supposed to ride as near to the right of the roadway as practicable, and that phrase is totally undefined. Mm-hmm. So in 2006, at the Ohio Bike Federation generated some new language to help to show that means you don't have to hug the white line. And in fact, most riding experts, and I'm sure Meredith and Tricia, have taught many people that you don't ride on the white line, even though it says as far right as practicable. There's a safety measure built in there, and it's safer to ride a few feet out. It's safer to ride in the right tire lane, but you should not be lane splitting where you're riding between cars or riding up next to cars or those types of things. You should be acting like a vehicle in traffic, because that's what you are. You're operating a vehicle in traffic.
Why is it safer to be maybe at the right tire level?
Well, once you're in that right tire level, you're more visible to as a part of traffic. You're a few feet off the white line. You're in the lane. You know, many cyclists today wear very conspicuous clothing, bright yellows and greens and pinks and things. So at least we're a lot more visible than black jacketed, you know, folks from days gone by. But it also, once that motorist comes up behind you and sees you, it's very obvious that they must leave the lane to pass you. I can't tell you how many times I've been riding, and if I'm too far to the right and there's enough space in there and the motorist says, gee, I can squeeze by him without leaving the lane, they'll mm-hmm. do it every time. But once they break that plane of glass that's the lane line, they seem like they generally tend to give you a wider berth. Cycling in an urban setting is a little dicier with that because of the traffic and all of that. If you're in downtown Columbus or downtown Cincinnati, that's going to be a little different than if you're out in the country somewhere. But yeah, you should be riding off the white line a few feet. The law seems to say that you can't take the whole lane, but you should be towards the right. But in any case that I've handled, I've had experts to testify where that is, and almost to a T, they say a few feet off the right, the white line is where you should be.
Now, if there's bike lanes installed, you must use the bike lane?
Can I answer that one? Oh,
yeah go ahead.
That depends. Actually, in Columbus, the law says that we do not have to use the bike lane, and that was something that another one of our OBF members, Steve Hardwick, got written into the law that just because it's a bike lane does not require a cyclist to ride in the bike lane. And the reason we didn't want to be required to ride in the bike lanes is sometimes it's unsafe. Like at intersections, the safest thing to do is move out into the traffic lane to avoid those right hooks. And the bike lanes sometimes encourage a cyclist to pass on the right, which one of the things we teach is don't pass on the right. What I teach is even if there's a bike lane, if this car stopped for red light, stay behind the last car in line and then go on after the cars move on.
Let's take a couple calls now because they're stacking up. Carl, you're on the air. You want to talk about parking on the street and dooring. Why don't you explain to everybody what dooring is first? I know what it is.
Okay, good morning. I work in the campus area on High Street, so I'll park my car on High Street sometimes. And I'm pretty conscious of, because I ride my bike myself sometimes, so I'm always trying to look in the mirror to make sure no one's behind me. But sometimes, you know, you don't always do that, and the bicyclists are coming by so fast, and it seems like they're not, it seems like they're in, like, the lane that I'm parked in on the street, and if you don't see them and you almost door them, they just run by real fast and scream at you and cuss at you and give you the finger and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So my question is, like, should they be in that parking lane, or should they be in the moving lane, you know, with the regular traffic as opposed to the parking lane where I'm at?
Okay.
So I don't hit them.
Who wants to get that?
Sense?
Yeah, makes sense to me.
You want to get that one there?
Well, yeah, I ride down High Street all the time. Usually I'll just take the entire right lane most of the way down, simply because it's too narrow of a lane to share. And yeah, indeed, you should be probably 6 feet at least from a car that's parked. And so that means that would put you roughly into the middle of the left lane. And so that is the safe thing to do. It can be tough if that lane of traffic doesn't break enough for you to get over in the amount of time you'd need to. So it's not always as easy as that. I think also people will get mad at you if you're, you know, riding for an entire
right.
stretch.
The anger
down.
Function. Steve, who would be at fault?
Well, that's interesting, Ann, because it brings up a lot about the tensions between the bicyclist and the traffic and the bicyclist and the obstacles that we're trying to ride around. If you're driving down the road and you're to the right and you're popping out the past parked cars and popping back in and out, it doesn't look like you're, you know, in a very predictable way, and you're kind of setting yourself up for some dangers from cars behind you. But then again, as was pointed out, if you're taking the lane and you're far enough out so you're not going to get doored, you run the risk of angering the motorist behind you. To me, the better approach is to anger the motorist behind you and ride in a straight line, because in the dooring situation, the person opening the door is at fault.
Okay.
The law says you're not allowed to open your door into traffic. We teach people to try to look at that as you're riding and look to see where the heads are in the cars and make sure you're taking precautions as a rider. But mm-hmm. but a motorist driving down the road doesn't have to, you know, it can pass close enough to the car door that it would take the door off if somebody opened it. You know, we don't have that option unless you're, you know, a 300-pound cyclist. You're not going to take the door off. You're going to get stopped by the door. So it's more self-preservation from our end.
Okay. Carl, thanks for your call.
Okay, thank you.
Take care. Jen wants to ask about why biking on sidewalk is illegal, and it's not always legal, but Jen, go ahead.
Yeah, I was always curious about that. There's probably a really good reason for it, but I just wondered why bikes belong on the road instead of the sidewalk. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you, Jen.
Thank you.
Well, I was going to say, historically, sidewalk cycling has generally been banned in urban areas. Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, Dayton, Toledo, Youngstown, they probably all have sidewalk cycling bans, particularly in the downtown areas, because you get somebody moving at 10 to 15 miles an hour, and there's dozens and hundreds of pedestrians walking. That becomes a very dangerous situation for the pedestrians. Plus, at every intersection, it presents the cyclist with a number of lousy choices as to how to proceed. Do you dismount and walk? Do you ride slowly? Do you zip through the crosswalks? Or what do you do with and those types of things? And so it's more of a, I think, pedestrian safety than it is banning bikes from riding as much. It's keeping people safer.
And Tricia, why are they allowed, for instance, in, say, I think Upper Arlington permits them?
I think it depends on each city ordinance is different, but most of the cities, the suburbs typically would allow it on the residential streets, but not on the business districts. And the other thing is a lot of cities allow children on the sidewalk. So even Columbus, isn't that true? I think Columbus mm-hmm. allows children on sidewalks, and they don't define what children is, so I'm assuming it means under age 18. But again, like when we teach children, we teach them when they get to be about age 10 and above, they should try to ride on the roads, at least residential streets. I'm always concerned about teaching young children to ride on the roads before they're ready, and it's like it depends on the kid how old they are when they're responsible enough. But if they are going to have to ride on the sidewalk, we teach them to ride slowly, watch for cars backing up, stop at every intersection, and so on, as if they were walking.
You know, bicycles, to get a driver's license, you have to take a driver's ed course. Of course, you don't have to take it every year or every 2 years or whenever you renew your license, but you do have to take one so that you know there are rules. Sometimes I come across kids who are riding their bike the wrong way on the street, facing traffic, and they don't seem to even know that there are rules because maybe they've been riding on the bike paths or something mm-hmm. like that. And, you know, Meredith, you're nodding.
I get very bored of the conversation of back and forth of you're not stopping at stop signs. Well, you're not doing this or that. Mm-hmm. And okay, yes, that is true with cyclists. Some of them don't. Some of them do it willfully. Many of them have absolutely no idea that any. And so I try to have people imagine a world in which there's no driver's education, there's no enforcement of traffic laws whatsoever, and just it's a free for all. And I think, you know, you can take a look at, for example, some traffic scenarios in Indonesia to see, to imagine, or other Asian countries, to imagine what that would be like. And so to try to engender some compassion for that circumstance of just sort of making it up as you go along and trying to do the right thing and have an inexpensive form of transportation, but, you know, you're completely unfamiliar with how to navigate. And so there's plenty of cyclists out there that are advocating for education. They're begging the law enforcement to enforce traffic laws. And, you know, there's just absolutely no support. So from a systems perspective, it's absolutely understandable that there's this sort of melee out there on the streets.
Can I add a comment, too? I just wanted to promote, too, there's the Safe Routes to School program. That's the national program promoting children to walk and bike to school. And that's really going gung-ho in Ohio right now. So there's a lot of funding available for education of children on the safe, the rules for riding bikes and for walking. So I'm hoping, you know, things will get better. I just have to thank Julie Walkoff in ODOT, who leads the – she's the state coordinator for ODOT, for Safe Routes to Schools.
Hey, one other thing on the mm-hmm. education angle, it seems like the best time to do that would be when kids are learning to drive cars, mm-hmm. but there's a complete lack of education of potential motorists about the rules of cycling. I know I think Trish has had some experience trying to get the state of Ohio to at least put a question in, a single question, let alone a course or curriculum. And we've gone round and round with driving schools and other places trying to get them to delete the bad material.
Why is there resistance to this, Tricia?
What I understand is that because it's not as big a problem as, say, the number – they basically are looking at where the high crashes are. So the motorcycles have a lot higher crash rates and pedestrians have a lot higher crash rates. So I guess our problem isn't as big as these other problems. And, we've been working on that for like 2 years to try to get some more education in driver's ed schools. We're actually making some progress, I think, but it's slow.
We have an email.
Go ahead. I was going to say, I think the good thing about what Meredith just said is that cycling is safe.
Mm-hmm.
It's statistically safe. It's not in general a problem. I think there are shipwrecks that occur, you know, that get publicized sometimes to make it seem like it's not as safe as it is. But in reality, we have hundreds of thousands of people riding bikes, if not millions, in Ohio, riding millions and millions of miles. And, you know, last year there were 18 deaths and I think 1,500 injuries for all of that reported on statistically. So
safer than walking.
It is by far much safer than walking.
That's interesting.
That's a good point.
We have an email from JT. This is a good question. What's the recommendation as a cyclist when you approach a red light with the intent to turn left and there are no cars stopped to trip the light? Should it be treated as a stop sign or should you hold back and wait for a car to come past you and trip the light? And I've been in that situation before. What's the rule?
We kick that around a lot in the Ohio Bike Federation in trying to adopt some changes in the law. The law currently says if the traffic signal is malfunctioning, then you can treat it as a stop sign. If it's functioning appropriately but it's not reading, you're not mm-hmm. heavy enough, or you don't have enough metal on your body to set off the electronic trigger. Does that mean it's malfunctioning? I would argue that it is, and if you wait around a while and it's obviously not changing, I would treat it as a stop sign and then go, and then if you get a ticket, you know, call me and we'll fight about it.
Okay.
can I make a suggestion to you? If you find a signal that's like that, find out who the city engineer is and let them know, and they can actually adjust the sensitivity on that detector to make it work for bikes. So
let's take another call from Ann. Wants to talk about those speed limits. Ann, you're
yes.
on the air. Thanks for waiting.
I'm against the rules. I've been hit twice on bike, once in Michigan, once here, and I've been turned over twice on my little 50cc motorcycle, which I tend to like to use at about 25 to 30, where somebody shaves me too close, and I go over with that thing. It's incredibly difficult to get it right up again, and of course, there's somebody behind you.
Right.
I've been going around and around with the county engineers on this, saying on a lot of these roads, they need to have an automatic reduction of speed rather than leaving, you know, the suburban sprawl stuff at 45 or even 55 where there is no edge, so that the cyclists, or in my case, my little I have a, everybody else calls it a moped. It is not a moped. I'm driving it about
as is it like a scooter?
As a moped. And in fact, one time it was a cop in Michigan up near Kalamazoo that passed me too close and forced me in a ditch. And,
wow.
You know, I still have the scar on my leg
Jeez.
Where the exhaust landed.
Ugh.
And trying to force them to say, listen, we have this many houses. This is not country anymore. This is a suburban area. Drop the speed limit automatically. I've been going around with them in a sprawl area now for 15 years.
And what do they say? They just don't have enough incidents to...
The law is that they have to do an engineering survey before they drop the speed limit. It should be exactly mm-hmm. reversed, and it is in Michigan. They automatically dropped the speed limit. I come from suburban Detroit, and once they got so many houses on an area, they dropped it to 25 from 35 mm-hmm. on Gros Hill, so that they would not have this thing happen. But, you know, I was hit on Fifth Avenue. I mean, I wasn't hurt that much. I got up and I kicked the guy's lights out.
Guess not.
Well, it helped.
We don't mean to laugh at your expense, though.
You know, I was black and white and wearing a badge. That sort of helped a little bit. I think the guy was freaked. But I wouldn't kick four headlights out of him, because essentially it was a 45-mile-an-hour thing on Fifth Avenue. It's the 45 versus mm-hmm. 35 that seems to be the critical factor. I've mm-hmm. been hit on bikes, and I've been hit forced off the okay. road on my first it was a Honda 50, now I've got a People 50.
Okay. You know, Ann, we got to take a break.
Okay.
And I appreciate your call.
Okay.
All right. Take care. Drive safe.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Or pedal or whatever. Okay. Well, as I said, we're going to take a quick break. We have lots of calls and maybe some emails coming up. If you would like to join the fray, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Join WOSU Public Media today by becoming a volunteer. WOSU Spring Pledge Drive is coming up, and we need your help. Help answer calls from WOSU listeners just like you from May 6th through May 14th. There are many opportunities for you to help out. For more information, including dates and times, call 292-9678 or visit wosu.org/volunteer. And thank you for your support of WOSU. And in just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here. And the discussion next hour, we'll hear changes that the U.S. military is using is using a false diagnosis of personality disorder to deny many medical and disability benefits to some soldiers wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan. We'll discuss those charges beginning at 11 o'clock right here on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
67 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high of 78 today, a few clouds tonight, a slight chance of rain, otherwise cloudy, and a low of 53 degrees. Sunshine for Tuesday, a chance of morning rain and a high of 75, and more sunshine on Wednesday with a high of 82. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. One of the big chunks of our community that we often don't necessarily think about is OSU. And there's a lot of bicyclists at OSU, and it can get a little frenzied there on any given school day, and it seems like there's nothing there in the summer. But right about now today, I bet you it's pretty busy there. Meredith, what is your impression of how OSU has handled the bike traffic and handles this issue on campus?
Well, it's been interesting. I've been out of school for maybe a year now, and back when I was there studying for my master's, we did sit down with Guy, and that was prior to
Gordon Guy, the president. Yeah.
Yes, Gordon Guy promised us the completion of the trail, which has happened. My understanding, that's phase one of the bike plan that was created for the university area, so everyone was pleased with that. I think people were more concerned with some of the phase two and phase three issues around cycling on the actual campus itself. And I don't know the plan for that, although I have seen recently a survey that went out through transportation and parking about cycling behaviors on campus. So that's promising. Although, you know, it's disappointing. There's been, I think, what, four or five new parking garages that were built recently on campus, and other schools in the country are, for example, giving all their freshman class bicycles when they come to campus, you know, and so
wow.
You still have somewhat of a disappointment around the types of things that are out there that could be done that we have not yet seen. So good and bad. I've my most frequent complaint happens to be just the roadway conditions, and I think those are fairly poor on campus and throughout the university district in general. I think that's among the best things you could do for cyclists is to make sure the roads are clear and
clear of debris, clear of bumps and cracks and potholes. Yeah.
Like just try to ride up Indianola, which is a good road to choose if you don't want to be on High or Summit, you know. But Indianola's horrible.
Which is a university district.
It doesn't belong to OSU, but yeah, it'd be nice if some of the roads around campus were better shape.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's take a call right now from David. You want to talk about infrastructure as to David, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. We certainly appreciate the support that the city administration has given, especially the mayor, to bicycling. But I'm also concerned about the lack of progress. The plans are great, but I see a long time in implementation. And unless we build an infrastructure, it's doubtful that bicycle commuting is going to increase by more than those folks like Meredith and Tricia who have the skills to ride in the system, but many, many bicyclists do not. In Copenhagen and Toronto, in Amsterdam, they built an infrastructure that supports 20 to 30% bicycle commuting. Unless that happens in Columbus, I don't expect the numbers to change a whole lot from where they are now. Do you all see anything happening from either the city or MORPC or the suburbs to implement those changes and in the infrastructure and change the emphasis from recreational construction to commuting construction, which is built to different standards?
Meredith?
Well, there's a couple of different things I want to say about that. First is, you know, you see really rapid transformation of the landscape in Europe and in Latin America, and in certain pockets of the United States, obviously, where cycling is more accepted and encouraged. But one thing we have to keep in mind about the American system of governance is that democracy creates certain opportunities and then also certain challenges. So, you know, you will wrangle over one roadway for a year or more, 2 years, 10 years in some cases. And so and then it happens on a piecemeal fashion throughout the city. And sometimes it just takes a lot longer than in a place where there's a more centralized type form of governance. So so there are challenges around doing that quickly. Now, I will say that San Francisco saw more than 50% increase in cycling, and they had a complete ban on any type of cycling infrastructure as they awaited an EPA review of their infrastructure projects for cycling. So that's why I tend to focus on the cultural and the community aspect, because it's more immediate, first of all, and also because I think it tends to be overlooked as a solution to encouraging cycling.
Meaning there's more people that are actually out on the road cycling, right, the safer you actually are. It's more
right.
visible.
I totally agree with that. Like mm-hmm. in Gahanna, just in the past couple years, I've just seen a lot more cyclists. I don't know if it's through the Yay Bikes forum and people are talking about it and people are seeing each other bike or what. But I just think that just the fact that there's more cyclists out there, I can see that the motorists seem to be more aware, more thoughtful, courteous. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do the infrastructure. David, mm-hmm. I agree with you. We can do that. But I don't think it's the only answer. I think education is a huge thing, and that's why that's my big push is education.
Okay, David, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Let's see. Paul wants to talk a little bit more about you want to talk about a case that Steve covered, that Steve Magus covered.
Yeah, hi, Steve. This is Paul Tay from Tulsa, Oklahoma, listening to you on stream right now.
And, hi, Paul.
I got to know Steve because of a case that he worked on called Trotwood versus Self, which is actually a landmark case for cycling, because it actually inspired the mainstream motoring society to look at bicycles in a completely different way, in that bicycles are traffic. We are actually normal and reasonable flow of traffic, and that bicyclists cannot be convicted of impeding traffic simply because they are part of traffic. So if you the city of Trotwood tried to do was to ban bicycling by charging Mr. Sells with going too slow on the road and not able to keep up with motor vehicle traffic, when everybody knows that bicycles at 20 miles an hour is reasonable and normal part of traffic. And just because a bicycle can't keep up with 40 miles an hour, 50 miles an hour, 60 miles an hour does not mean that they are a foreign alien object on the road.
You know, Steve, I was going to bring up go ahead, Paul. I'm sorry.
And that case actually inspired other cases. There are a number of cases similar to this case across the country, one in Arizona that I know of, one in Texas that I know of. And my own case, I've got a case in appeals court, exactly the same situation as Trotwood versus Seltz, and I'm waiting for a resolution to that. And I actually used Steve's briefs to write up my brief on a pro se basis. And I want to quickly, you know, comment about some of the other things that people brought up real quick. We need to include bicycle driving skills with motor vehicle driver's ed at the high school level.
Okay.
And there's got to be at least three mm-hmm. questions on the exam, on the driver's exam, just like California has related to bicycles. Here in Oklahoma, we do a great job of educating bicycle issues in the manual, but we're still trying to fight. We're still trying to get those three questions on the test.
Okay, Paul, thanks a lot for your call. We have a whole bunch of people waiting, but I appreciate your call and thanks for streaming.
Okay.
All right.
Can I answer the driver test? We did submit, like, in our driving test in Ohio, it actually, the test that each person takes is generated from a list of 600 questions. So we were asked to provide, like, 20 bicycle-related questions to test, and we've done that. Ohio Bike Federation has submitted those, and so we're hoping to get those questions added to our driver's test so that the people taking driver's ed have to learn what the laws are about bicyclists before they start driving.
Getting back to that whole bike trail issue, there's one culture for the Olentangy, for instance, the Olentangy bike trail, and then there's another one for the roads. There's another one for country roads and city roads, and you know, it changes up all the time. Wherever you go, you get different kinds of behaviors. Scott on Facebook wrote that his problem with bike riders on the Olentangy trail who think they are racing in the Tour de France. Every time I try to take my kids for a walk, there is some guy who nearly runs us over, and there are some fast bikers over there, and I know it's a 15-mile-per-hour speed limit, but
yeah, even 15 miles an hour is kind of fast for trying to pass a walker and kids and dogs and all that kind of stuff. So if you want to ride fast, you really shouldn't be on the bike trail, and you have to really yield to the pedestrians. I mean, it's a multi-use path. It's not a bike path. So if you're going to choose the bike path, you need to be courteous.
Statistically, you're a lot more likely to have a crash on a bike path than you are on the road as well. And that's because of that. Mm-hmm. You're sharing the path with 5-year-olds on big wheels, you know, horses and, you know, rollerbladers, and you've got about a 6 or 8 foot piece of asphalt to work with, as opposed to, you know, riding where you're supposed to be on the roadway. So.
And sometimes it's just people riding abreast of each other, just kind of doing a slow ride.
Yeah.
And you have the guys that are riding very fast through, and you can tell they're fast riders.
I think, like, you know, when people are using the trail for commuting in the mornings when there aren't a lot of recreational people walking or biking, then they can go a little faster. You know, most of the people that are on it are there to get to work. So, but it depends on the time of day and the weekends and all that.
You know, Steve, speaking of dogs, tell us about what Ohio's dog law is in regards to cycling safety.
Well, Ohio has one of the very best dog laws in the country with regard to protecting cyclists. Assuming that you're not trespassing on someone's property and the dog leaves someone's property to come towards you, if the dog causes a crash, the owner is liable automatically. It doesn't matter what kind of electric fence the owner had or what kind of leash or the fact that the dog broke free and it wasn't the owner's fault. If the dog causes a crash, not bites you, but causes a crash, then the owner's liable. And those claims are covered under the owner's homeowner's policy. So there's, I've done, I don't know, 50, 60 dog cases at least. And, you know, they can cause really bad injuries, but fortunately there's some protection under the law for cyclists. Generally, the dogs just want to play. Occasionally, you get aggressive dogs that are, you know, trying to get you, but a lot of times these cases come because the dogs are running next to you, or they cut you off, or they literally run into your bike, just and then they come and lick your hand when you're laying on the ground.
Because, they're just doing their job. We have an email from Kelly who writes, roads are for trucks, passenger cars, and motor vehicles. How often do people drive on sidewalks and bike paths? Bike riders simply need to acknowledge their surroundings and proceed accordingly. Further, a cyclist cannot get hit if they are not on the road. Now, of course, this is not the case, that roads are for bicycles, right, Steve?
Absolutely. Back in the 1880s, when before there were paved roads, there were millions of cyclists who fought to get the roads paved. And in fact, the Cincinnati Cycle Club was founded around 1880, as was the League of American Wheelmen, when the very first vehicle codes were written, when back in the early 1900s, when legislatures were wrestling with these same issues, how do we handle, you know, these newfangled motor cars and the bicyclists and the horses and the buggies and the donkeys? Bicycles were given a special treatment by being included in the definition of vehicles and being included in the category of vehicles that are allowed to be operated on the roadway. So we've been in the law with a right to use the roadways in Ohio since the very first vehicle codes were ever written. And that's been reinforced time and time again. And in fact, in 2006, we reinforced that again. So legally, the roads are not made for cars, trucks, and buses. The roads are made for public ways to enable people to transport themselves from place to place. by any number of legitimate and legal means, including Amish buggies, slow-moving farm equipment, bicycles, and cars, trucks, and buses.
We have another question from Sally now about, I guess, Sally, we've already talked about bikers obeying the speed limits, but you wanted to talk about child carriers.
Yes, but you haven't addressed my question about the what I think about the speed limit. If bikes are required to obey the same rules of the road as cars, then why don't they have to obey the speed limit and go, like, for instance, I travel Riverside Drive frequently, two-way, most of the places can't pass behind a bike that's not going anywhere near 50.
Well, that's a speed limit, though. That's not a speed minimum. Steve,
well,
what about
that? I wasn't talking about that. There's very few roads here that all travel there want to go the 50 mile as a rule. I certainly know I do, but I'm terrified to try to pass. Well, I can't pass if I want to be legal. I can't cross that yellow line.
Actually, we did talk about that earlier, Sally, but does anyone want to quickly address that? Because we've only got about a minute and a half to go.
Well,
Steve?
No, sure. In 2006, the law changed, and it said if the vehicle's traveling less than half the posted speed, then you are allowed to cross the double yellow line to pass. That change was made for the very reason that your caller talked about, that allows motor vehicles to pass bicyclists when they're not doing 50 miles an hour. But we have the right to ride even when it's 50 miles an hour speed limit.
Okay. Thank you, Sally, for your call. Sorry we couldn't get the other half of it, but I want to give Tricia a chance to make a pitch for – you got about 45 seconds, Tricia.
Okay.
Tell us everything, and then we'll do a link to WOSU.org/allsides for more on all of this.
Yeah, we wanted to make sure we let the listeners know about the Bike to Work Challenge, which is going to be happening May 10th to 20th, which is a program to promote biking to work. We want organizations to create teams and cyclists to ride their bikes, and we will be tracking. You can track your rides to work. Then there's awards for whoever has the most mode share in their business. And also we have a lot of events planned. Real quick, there's going to be a commuting class this Thursday. There's a launch of the challenge next Monday morning on the 10th. On the 18th, Steve Magus will give a talk. I think Ann already mentioned that. And then there's an award ceremony on May 21st. But go to our website, biketoworkchallenge.com.
Biketoworkchallenge.com or WOSU.org/allsides if you can't remember that. My thanks to Tricia Kovacs of the Columbus League of Cycling Instructor and also the Ohio Bicycle Federation. Thanks so much, Tricia. Meredith Joy of Yay Bikes, founder and a new instructor. Thanks, Meredith. And also Steve Magus, Ohio's bike lawyer. Thanks for being with us, Steve. All Sides with Ann Fisher on W.
When reporter Wendy Ruderman started investigating dirty cops, the reaction was intense.
The police put my home address on a website that they have, and they would say all kinds of nasty things like, you know, I hope that she gets, you know, robbed or raped or nobody comes to her aid.
On the next Fresh Air, Ruderman and Barbara Laker of the Philadelphia Daily News, they've just won the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins at noon on WOSU 820. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus. And streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.
WOSU Public Media and State Auto Insurance present Columbus Neighborhoods. This acclaimed documentary tells the story of one of our city's most vibrant and exciting neighborhoods, the Short North. Transformed from a rundown, forgotten part of the city into Columbus's center for arts and culture, take a fresh look at one of Columbus's great neighborhoods. Watch Columbus Neighborhoods with the Short North, Wednesday night at 9, only on WOSU-TV.
68 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1 minute before 11 o'clock. Sunshine today, a high of 78. Clouds tonight and a low of 53 degrees. More sunshine for Tuesday and a high of 75. And good morning from WOSU 820, NPR News. It's 11 o'clock.
How do we treat our veterans wounded in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? Depends on how you define the injury, according to an investigative reporter for The Nation magazine who covers military and veterans issues. Back in 2008, Joshua Kors broke the story about how the U.S. military routinely has used the diagnosis of personality disorder to discharge these war veterans to avoid the cost of treatment. He's writing about this practice again, this time about the man who founded Disposable Veterans, a one-man operation for soldiers fighting discharge and veterans appealing their disability rating. Find out more in a few minutes when we meet the reporter who broke the story in 2008. Listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.